danger is stealing in as relapse hums above the din. It's hard to know if this will be the day.
Hello and welcome to episode 206 of the Thinking Poker Podcast. From Melrose, Massachusetts, I'm Nate Mavis, and with me from Owings Mills, Maryland, is...
It doesn't matter what your name is!
Andrew Brokus. How are you, Andrew?
Pretty good. I've been a little under the weather the last couple days, but I think my voice probably sounds normal at this point, eh?
Yeah, you sound good. You sound good.
Thanks. I'm always sort of, I don't know, I feel like I'm just sort of making excuses, because we're recording this on a Friday morning, and I generally do poker on Friday afternoon, evening, and now that I'm in the Maryland area, I always feel like I should be going to National Harbor, because that's where all the big games are, but it's like, it's a really unpleasant drive from the Baltimore area down to the DC area, and it's much closer to go to Maryland Live, much more convenient, don't have nearly the same bad traffic issues, and... But it's sort of, you know, the biggest game I'm going to play there is like 2-5 with a $600 buy-in. And so I'm just always having this kind of like internal debate over whether I'm going to make that drive. But I think the still recovering from sickness is going to be the last straw, because usually I don't want to go to National Harbor to play a short session. Like, if I'm going to drive down there, I want to play for a while, and I don't want to feel like obliged to stay late if I'm, you know, tired and still a little bit sick. So
yeah,
I think I'm giving myself an excuse to just do Maryland Live today.
Well, good luck there. And as we like to talk about, unless you're going to be playing 1025 or something, a good 2-5 is very often comparable or even better than a whatever 5-10.
That's the other thing, is like the National Harbor game. So like I think I'm yet to see a 1025 go in there that I really wanted to be playing in. I've played a little bit of it, but a decent amount of the time, even when it's going, I'm still playing the 510. And it may be that the 1025 is getting better like later in the evening. I've been doing more like daytime-ish sort of hours and leaving like 11 or midnight. So, I mean, maybe that game is better at like 2 or 3 a.m. That wouldn't surprise me. But, and even the 5-10's been pretty hit or miss there. I mean, there's a lot of good players who are around the National Harbor area right now. And so depending on, you know, like if there's a 10-25 going and there's three tables of 5-10 going, then like the 5-10's, at least one or two of them can be pretty good. But, you know, if there's two tables of 5-10 and, you know, the 10-25 isn't going or it's shorthanded or something, then the 5-10 can be pretty bad. So, and then like there can be long waits and there's a lot of X factors involved in going to National Harbor right now.
Yeah. It's funny. I have a very roughly analogous situation right now, in that there's a new room in Nashua, New Hampshire, which is really just my backyard. It's 40 minutes away. And Foxwoods is 2 hours away.
Is the new room Twin Rivers?
No, Twin Rivers. That's next on my list. That's in Rhode Island. Okay. So, there's Charity Poker in New Hampshire, Twin Rivers in Rhode Island, and Foxwoods at Foxwoods. And, you know, there's a way to do the 2-hour drive so that it's sort of nice and pleasant, but still it's a bit more of a drive, and it's a whole to do. Whereas, you know, there's a 2-4 no limit game right in my backyard, and especially, you know, 2-4 is the biggest game they can spread. So, at least the time I was there, I was not the only person putting the 10 on under the gun. So, you know, a 2-4-10 game right in my backyard in a slightly new market, it's pretty good. It's pretty good.
And I mean, I can't imagine it's a game that too many other serious players are going to.
Yeah, when I was there, you know, there were a few nits, but there were a lot of, it was as yet untrafficked by the very serious players who seemed to prefer Twin Rivers. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's good. There were some like nits, but they were clearly just sort of local, you know, the local New Hampshire libertarians, you know, all about their all about their non-fiat currencies and folding a lot in early position.
No, I wish there were a like button for podcast discussions.
Yeah, no word yet on whether they're spreading a Bitcoin game there, or game denominated in Bitcoin. Yeah, so that's the situation there. But good luck. Good luck in your session tonight.
Thank you. And hopefully tomorrow, Saturday, I'll feel up to putting in a nice long session at National Harbor.
Yeah. And good luck there. Thank you. So what else? Speaking of drives that I have to make, down the Acela corridor, is there anything else we got?
So people listening to this probably know by now, if you've been listening to or following us on Twitter or whatever, we, along with the Just Hands Poker Podcast, are going to be hosting a live event in the New York City area, March 25th or 26th, and you can come on either of those days. You don't need to be available both. If you did not know that already, well, we're going to be hosting a live event in the New York City area, March 25th or 26th, so now you know. It's going to consist of a meet and greet with us, a meal, and a deep stacked 1-2 cash game, of which you will get a recording with commentary from the four of us. So it's a great opportunity to meet us, to meet other members of the Thinking Poker community, and to get an outside perspective on every aspect of your live poker game, which can be tricky to do. You know, people, you can discuss individual hands with your friends or with a coach or something like that, but it's not like online where you can just send a full hand history to somebody and have them comment on all those hands. You know, the stuff that you don't realize is an issue, whether it's related to tells or hands that you're folding that you wouldn't even think to ask somebody, you know, should I have played this or whatever. I think getting that kind of like global perspective on your game is pretty valuable.
I completely agree. And I am preparing for this not only by playing a bunch of live poker, but also by watching a bunch of live streams on the internet, which is something that I usually do, I guess. But that 100-200 cash game with Berkey and others, the Poker Night in America game, that's fun to watch. I should also apologize to anybody who is listening to this, because it's possible, like, you know, a conditional apology. If you are very excited about this event, and if you drop everything and rush to your computer and try to buy a seat, and if they are all sold out by the time this podcast is released, I'm very sorry about that. But, you know, hopefully we'll repeat this event at some point later. I know we're low on seats, but and there's no way of looking into the future and know whether any are available by the time you're listening here.
Yeah, there are four different sessions. There are two on Saturday and Saturday the 25th, and two on Sunday the 26th. So you would be able to hopefully attend any one of those four. Although, again, you know, as we get closer to the event, we are starting to sell out some of those sessions. So you want to make sure that you go to justhandspoker.com/thinkingpokernyc. If that's too much for your lazy butt to type, then you can also look for a link in the show notes or look on Twitter. We in the Just Hands Poker have been tweeting this almost every day, and check out that link and you'll see the latest availability in terms of what sessions are still available, and if you have any questions about the event or that sort of thing, you should be able to find the information you need at justhandspoker.com/thinkingpokernyc.
You know, I think it's been a while since we blasted our actual contact information, did the ordinary housekeeping. If you would like to send us a hand or say anything else about the show, podcast@thinkingpoker.net. That's podcast@thinkingpoker.net. If you would like to tweet at us, Andrew is @thinkingpoker, all one word. And if you tweet at him, I might reply instead. That's just something you have to live with. if you want me specifically on Twitter, I am @NateMavis, first name, last name, all one word.
I probably will not respond if you tweet only at Nate.
Yeah.
I was going to say something else. Oh, yeah, about in terms of sending us hands. So today we are just going to be going through some hands that were sent to us, and this will give you an idea of what you're in for if you send us a hand. Certainly not a guarantee that your hand is going to get on the air. We receive a lot more hands than we can discuss, but this is what you're in for. Sometimes we're critical, but we try to give you useful information.
Yeah, I agree. I've got one sort of general thing to say beforehand. I don't know. Yeah, so I just wanted to give a shout out to various other shows that are out there. I have been spending a little more time on YouTube lately, which is funny because I have found that YouTube's discovery engine has started working markedly better for me, like right before YouTube hit that 1 billion hours watched per day milestone that's been all over the news. But
I actually haven't heard that. But congratulations, yeah. YouTube. I've done my little part. I'm responsible for a couple hundred hours of this.
Yeah, and there was a while there where I wasn't really consuming a lot of other poker podcasts. I was more just talking about hands and reading books and stuff like that. But now Andrew Nemi does a good vlog. I like it. It's he sort of takes you through Vegas and California with him as he goes to different card rooms. He flies his drone, so you get these nice panoramic drone shots of just San Diego and such. And he also sort of sets the camera up at the table and videotapes hands, and then he talks about them afterward with some strategy.
This is kind of controversial some places, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it is. I think it is. But for the viewer, it is fantastic. I feel like I'm in Las Vegas. I really enjoy it. And like the strategy, he comes at things from like a different angle than I would sometimes. So A, I'm learning things, and B, I get the joy of sort of yelling at my computer screen and telling him how bad he's playing sometimes. But like, he's a good player. He's a pro. He beats 5'10". This is all, it's all very good. So I like that. I've been going through the Brian Koppelman The Moment archives, not only for Koppelman interviews, but also he's had some poker players on, especially 1 and 2 years ago. If you haven't checked those out, there's interesting stuff with Negreanu and Helmuth and Vanessa Selbst. All good interviews. I think the Phil Helmuth interview in particular is the best one I've ever heard, like specifically the Phil Helmuth interview, just because Brian's a very skilled interviewer and really manages to handle Phil very well. So there are like gems, such as Phil casually claiming to have played perfect backgammon at age 10. But like, really, it's a remarkably open and honest interview. I really enjoyed it. And Daniel Negreanu does have his own podcast now, and some parts of it are better than others, but it's really well worth checking out. I enjoy listening to it. There's some strategy there. He pitches it at a variety of levels. Good guests, as you would expect from possibly the single most famous poker player in the world. And I'm just happy we're living in a time of abundant poker media, and some of it's actually really good.
And if you get sick of the really good stuff, there's always the Thinking Poker podcast.
Yeah, hundreds of hours of archives you got.
If you are already a member of TournamentPokerEdge.com, then you'll be excited to see my newest series there, which is a hand history review from a 6-max World Championship of Online Poker event. Lots of interesting spots come up when you're playing shorthanded, and it's just a chance to see me talking through some pretty high-level tournament poker. If you're not a member, then let this be your impetus to sign up for as little as $25 a month. You'll get access to hundreds of hours of poker strategy content. You will find that at TournamentPokerEdge.com. Our first email today is coming to us from John. It's from a 2-5 no-limit game in Vegas. Playing nine-handed, an irrelevant player limps in under the gun one. The main villain calls in the hijack with about $500 behind. Our hero covers and is in the cutoff with ace of clubs, queen of diamonds. So basically we've got two limpers, hero in the cutoff with ace-queen offsuit, raises to $25. And John says, "This could you could certainly argue for raising larger here, and I probably should have, as the table was quite loose pre-flop." And I agree with his assessment there, especially in a looser game. Like, I think 25 is like the smallest that I would raise to with two limpers in front, and I would often lean towards raising a bit larger anyway, just because, you know, a game where there's two limpers is probably a loose game. But if you know that it's a loose game or the limpers are on the looser side, then I like raising more. Essentially raising the largest amount that I think they'll call with bad hands. Do you agree, Nate?
Yes, I agree. No, I think that's right. I think 25 is fine. I would make it 30. And I think,
not a huge difference either way. An irrelevant player in the small blind calls. I assume he means he becomes irrelevant to the hand, not that he is an irrelevant human being. An irrelevant player in the small blind calls, the initial limper calls, and the cutoff calls. So we go four ways to the flop, $105 in the pot.
John wait, says, sorry, but when you post the flop in the show notes, can you do a hyperlink to video of The Rock saying it doesn't matter what your name is?
I don't know that. I mean, I guess I can Google it. It's not a reference I'm familiar with.
Old school WWE reference, or 10 years ago WWE reference. Never mind. Sorry, Sean.
No, we're leaving that in there.
Okay.
John says, I don't have a real good read on the main villain, other than that he is too loose pre-flop, and I hadn't seen him make any particularly aggressive plays or show down any bluffs over the 1 to 2 hours he had been at the table. Certainly a recreational player. Only hand I recall him, seeing him show down was a set, and it was not very revealing interesting. So the flop with our hero again, holding ace of clubs, queen of diamonds, 4 to the flop, $105 in the pot. The flop is queen of clubs, 7 of clubs, 3 of clubs. So top pair, top kicker, and the nut flush draw for our hero. Checks to the main villain, who leads for $30. And so this is the main villain here being the hijack. And our hero in the cutoff elects to just call. John says, I have no idea what hands he leads here. A flush would not shock me. A 7 would not shock me. A queen would not shock me. A set maybe could be possible, but sizing seems too small for a set. Two pair could also be possible. Some king of clubs combinations, such as king jack with the king of clubs. Could argue for raising here, but I figure I have position. My hand doesn't really benefit from protection. I would hate to get re-raised, and there are two other players who could overcall with hands which are in very poor shape relative to my hand. Once again, I like John's analysis a good bit here. Anything you want to add to that?
I would raise every time. Yeah. I mean, not that. So I like what John is saying. I think that betting 30 into 100 something, one hand type that John is not mentioning is a pocket pair, probably with a club, like fours with the four clubs, I think fits the limp call lead out small behavior not too bad. I think that hands that lead may fold later but will often call a raise now. I think that hands behind you that will call 30 will not always call 150, but will sometimes call 150, and the times that they fold, sometimes you have them crushed, and that's too bad, but sometimes you don't, and I would start building a pot. So I would raise it here probably to 125 or something like that, expecting to get called by hands like 8-7 with the 8 of clubs, pocket 8s with the 8 of clubs, king queen offsuit, hands like that.
Yeah, that's fair. Maybe I'm reading too much into, or not reading enough into the bet sizing. Like, I think if the villain bet more like $60, I'd be a lot less inclined to raise.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. But 30 into, I don't know.
Into 105, like, yeah, that's fair.
Yeah. And, like, sometimes, I think this is important, sometimes people just have no idea how much is in the pot, but here 30 is almost the same as the preflop raise size, and he's betting such a small fraction of the pot, and it should be salient to him that he's doing that. So it's not like, I mean, he could be saying like, I have a set, I will bet $30, but like more likely A, he would try to protect it, and B, he would just, if he's just going to throw out a bet size and not pay any attention to what's in the pot, I think that would be like 50 or 60.
Yeah, that's fair. I think you've sold me on this. I do. I mean, I like John's kind of general instinct of thinking like this is a pretty good calling hand and arguably not good enough to raise for value against a more balanced flop bet, but I think there's good reason to believe the $30 is just like pretty weak, and that the villain is likely to, or and all the villains at the table are likely to call a raise with more hands than they should.
Yeah, and let me say also, the reason to raise is not because you have a pair and also a draw, so you sort of won't ever be in too bad a shape or whatever. Like, it's not like one of these, I have a combo, girl, I'll just move all in, how bad can it be? There are specific hands. We have specific reasons to think that we're crushing the bettor's range, or at least doing very well against it, and we can figure to get called by worse hands if we raise. You know, the fact that we have a good hand and also have a draw, that's nice, but it doesn't by itself mean that we should just shovel money into the pot. You know,
I think that's why I was celebrating John's decision to call, just because I was so happy that he didn't fall into that trap of just being like, it was a good flop for me, so I started throwing money into the pot, which is, I mean, and you often should throw money into the pot when you get a good flop. It's just, it doesn't automatically follow, and sometimes the hand will play better not as a bet or a raise, and a lot of people don't even, you know, consider anything else. They're just like, well, it was a good flop, so I bet.
Yep.
The other players both folded to the $30 bet, and we go to the turn, which is the eight of hearts. So now $165 in the pot, heads up. The flop, or the board, is queen, 7-3, all clubs, plus the eight of hearts on the turn, our hero holding ace, queen with the ace of clubs. Villain bets $40. And I guess we should remind people also that there's still $445 in the effective stacks, $165 in the pot. Villain bets 40. Given that we didn't raise the flop, I assume you want to raise now?
Yeah. I mean, I think if he's testing like 40, it looks a lot like Queen Jack without the Jack of Clubs. Like, it sort of seems like a half-hearted protection bet. Like, I feel obligated to bet, but, you know, that's kind of scary.
Kind of like so, a blocking bet, too. Like, I'm afraid to check, so I guess I'll bet something and hope that you don't raise me.
Yeah, pocket nines. It could also be like, again, fours with the four of clubs, maybe nines without the nine of clubs. Queen Jack, again, maybe a little bit less likely to have the Jack of Clubs, something like that. I would probably raise. Like, I think, your hand looks like the dry ace a little bit sometimes. You can get a skeptical call. I think your opponent might be price sensitive here. I might make a little bit of an under raise in some live settings to try to get that call from the fours or from a queen I have drawing to two outs. So I would, like 150, I think. Maybe that's a little bit greedy, but greedy in the sense of trying too hard to get a call. So maybe not greedy. It's not greedy enough.
It's insufficiently greedy.
yeah. But I think 110 more, the pot's nice and big. I think that could be a price that could look good to him, but in fact be very, very bad indeed.
Yeah, and I do think we should think a little bit, and this is why you made sure to mention what's remaining in the effective stacks. I do think we should be looking with an eye towards jamming even blank rivers. I mean, I think obviously like most clubs are going to give us the nuts, but even if the river is, I can't think of many rivers I wouldn't want to shove. I can't think of any rivers I wouldn't want to shove the villain check to me. Off the top of my head, I really don't even know what a bad river would be if villain just calls this raise and checks. I think like we have a strong enough hand to jam on. I guess the worst possible river would be like an offsuit king, but I still, I think I still would want to jam that.
Yeah, that seems right. I think a king is pretty bad, but especially in a live game, like how many 2-5 villains who are playing king jack with the king of clubs or who are playing like king seven without the king of clubs or king queen without the king of clubs, how many of them are not going to give off any reaction when the king hits? Like really not that many, right? Like I would have the plan to shove, but also if the king hits, I would basically, might get angry email for this. I would just almost always make my decision based on physical information.
Yeah, so I think when we're thinking about the turn sizing, we do need to keep in mind that we would like to be able to set up a river shove as well, and what we don't want to do is make the turn size so small that then we're not able to shove the river, or in order to shove the river, we have to go larger than the size of the pot. And I think, Nate, the 150 that you suggest is about as small as we can go to set that up. So if we make it 150 on the turn, we'll end up with 465 in the pot on the river, and just about 400 in the effective stack. So it'll still be a pretty close to a pot-sized shove compared to only a little over a half pot-sized raise on the turn. So we've got pretty different fractions of the pot, which isn't the end of the world, especially given that, you know, we're not at all sure that the river shove is going to get paid off anyway. And we do, we can't get a river shove paid if we don't get a turn raise called. So,
yeah, and also this is something we talked about last time where you're thinking about threatening stacks a lot, and I said, hey, what are we targeting with our bluff? Like, I think the reason I want to raise less is because he's likely to have a hand like, and again, I know I've said this a couple times now, that like the fours, like the queen jack, those are hands that I would be trying to bluff, I think, if I moved in. I'm not sure how balanced we need to be. I think if we make it 150 on the turn and then bet half the stack on the river, like bet 175 to 225 on the river. Yeah, we don't get stacks, but we could get it. We could be much, much, much more likely to get called by two nines, two fours, queen jack, a hand like that. So I think in general, you know, you're playing no limit. You got to be thinking about the stack size, and I think that's right. I think in this specific situation, the value target might not be appropriate for an all in goal.
That's fair. And I really meant not so much to say the 150 was too small, but what ends up happening, John raises to 120, which I think is a little on the small side, not only in terms of not getting to threaten stacks, but just because I think, like, most hands they're going to call 120, you're going to call 150, or maybe even all hands they're going to call 120, we'll call 150. So I think he's really just leaving some money on the table by only raising to 120.
Yeah, I think that's right.
How did I lose this? Okay. And so John raises to 120. Villain calls without much hesitation. And John says, at this point, I assume I likely have the best hand and best draw and am raising for value. And I think when Villain just calls the raise, I mean, I was already pretty damn sure we had the best hand. But I think, you know, with Villain not re-raising, I think it becomes even more likely that we have the best hand. I mean, I guess, like, two paired, maybe even set, would just call, but I don't think he has a whole lot of combinations of those. So, I mean, the chance that he was, like, playing possum with a flush, I think, goes down when he only calls the raise. Sorry, do you want to say something there?
Yeah, I think that's right.
River is the eight of diamonds, making the final board queen 7-3-8-8. Three clubs on the flop, but no additional clubs coming on the turn to river. Our hero still holding ace queen with the ace of clubs for a final hand of two pair queens and eights. The villain leads for 175 into a pot of 405. John says, I have no clue what the hell he would ever lead here. The only possible bluffs I can think of are king nine to king jack with the king of clubs, but I really just don't think he would play those this way. At the same time, I really don't know what he ever value bets either. Perhaps 7-8, king clubs eight of diamonds, queen eight suited, perhaps a set that he played very strangely. In game, I had no clue what to put him on. I don't know. Do you have a clue what to put him on, or do you have a decision, even if you don't know what to put him on, what hero ought to do here?
Yeah, it's tough. So 7-8 makes sense. Like 7-8 with the eight of clubs, that's a thing that could happen. or even maybe 7-8 without the eight of clubs. Like, we didn't raise him on the flop, right? So I think, you know, he hits something on the flop, feels obligated to bet. On the turn, he makes two pair, bets again, can't fold to the raise, river fills up. I mean, I think that's possible. He might not have played 7-8 before the flop, but that's one sort of value hand he could have. It, like, waking up with a flush, I'm not sure how much that makes sense. Like, I just given all his previous play.
Yeah.
Like, he could have it, but we block. I mean, we can see the ace, queen, 7 and 3, and it really does make a big difference that, like, we can see the ace and another Broadway card, and the other two are spaced out by a few, because then, unless he's playing a lot of semi-connectors, it just blocks so many. Like, a lot of players don't play 7-5 and 9-7 and such, so then we block 8-7, 7-6, 4-3. Yeah, so another possibility, a lot of people in these games still do limp ace queen. I think that's possible. I don't think an overpair is very plausible. I think probably hands like nines would not wake up and bet. Probably not. I do think you'll see bluffs here sometimes. Like 5-6 with the six of clubs. That's a possibility, especially if, like, 7-8 offsuit is a possibility, 5-6 offsuit is a possibility. And I think some people will wake up and bluff the 6 high. I would call here. I think there aren't a lot of hands that beat you. And whatever this person's profile is, like, if he's tight pre-flop, it's hard for him to have you beat. If he's loose, then there are all these other hands that he could be bet calling or betting and then bet calling on the turn. Calling to chop is not great, but I do think in these kinds of games you'll see something like that sometimes. And I do think, like, a hand like king queen, queen jack, I think these hands, you know, might bet something like a blocker bet or something, you'd like one of these limit hold'em river bets where the money will go in better if you bet it yourself. And this sort of takes more and less sophisticated forms. So I don't love it, but I do think we're good here well over a third of the time. And in fact, we only need like 30%. I would call and expect to be good maybe as much as 60% of the time, maybe more. What do you think?
I think we need to be good less than 25% of the time, right? It's 175 into 405.
Yep, that's right. He's betting half the pot. Sorry.
Usually I'm the one who makes that. That's why I was like, wait, I'm not usually the one who's catching somebody on a on simple pot odds math error. Usually that's the way around. The main thing that I want to highlight is why this seems tricky, because I think a lot of people will call here without even thinking twice about it, and I'm glad that John, you know, isn't doing that, is thinking about it. And I want to highlight, you know, why this is a bit of a decision. I don't think it matters that much that we have ace queen, and I think it's downright bad that we have the ace of clubs in our hand. You know, you mentioned, Nate, the possibility of villain having king queen or jack queen, and to the extent that that is a possibility, it matters a lot that we have ace queen, because then we're actually beating hands that he's value betting, which means our hand is not a pure bluff catcher. I actually think those hands feel pretty unlikely to me with the sizings here. I think, like, the fact that villain was betting such small fractions of the pot on the flop and turn, because you're right that the king queen or jack queen, I mean, people aren't really thinking of those as like full value hands on the river. They're more kind of thinking of them as sort of like a blocking bet, I don't want to check call sort of bet. Even if, like, if they might have the best hand, I it doesn't really make sense to me that villain would bet such a larger fraction of the pot on the river than he did on the flop and turn, holding a hand like that.
That's right. It's why I mentioned it a little bit later in my analysis. But I do think that whatever villain has, he's playing it kind of funky no matter what.
Yeah.
And I mean, I really respect your analysis of these things a lot, but I have played a lot of hours of these games, and and I have seen people turn over stuff like that.
That's it. And we don't need to win very often here, given the price that we're getting. I mean, And that is why I would call, because I think there's a chance it matters that we have ace-queen, but I think it doesn't matter nearly as much as you might think, just looking at this and saying, like, oh, I have top pair, top kicker, and draws missed. Like, of course I'm going to call. I do think it's actually kind of difficult to put villain on a lot of hands that would be looking to bluff here, or to put him on hands that would be worse hands that would be betting for value. But as you say, I mean, it's a little difficult to put them on nutted hands as well. And I mean, we just don't need to win that often. I think when you have this, like, this degree of uncertainty and this much of an objectively strong hand, you probably shouldn't be folding the river getting better than 3-1.
Yeah. Like, is he really playing sevens full this way? Like, on the river, it looks right. But on the flop and turn, like, really? Just 30? And then he's not three betting.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah, I would call. What did our correspondent do, Andrew?
Our correspondent had no clue what to put the villain on, tanked for a couple of minutes, and begrudgingly folded. So we don't have any more exciting results to share with you. We did not get to see the villain's hand. And as I said, I don't think it's an atrocious fold. I mean, I wouldn't have folded, but I see the logic for it. And for, you know, for people listening, I think the most important thing to recognize is why this is something other than a snap call. Like, why this is even worth thinking about. Like, you know, if that's not obvious to you, I would say, you know, listen to this segment, or at least our discussion of the river decision again. As long as you understand, you know, why it's worth considering anything other than calling, I think, you know, you've gotten your value from this segment.
Yeah. So I think that's all fair, and I think it's really great that our correspondent's willing to fold here and willing to look past the absolute strength of his own hand and the fact that he probably felt pretty good on the flop. That's all fantastic. That said, when you say a fold isn't atrocious, I think it's probably about a $150 mistake. Really? In a lot of games. If we win half the time, you know, 300, 175 into 300, $650 pot. So you put in 175 and get like 325 back. Yeah.
Yeah.
That would be a $150 mistake. I mean, that's if you win like half the time. And maybe that's ambitious. Like, you know, he could have like ace eight with the eight of clubs. Would he really lead that on the flop? It's pretty funny when he turns that over. So, I mean, it's In some sense, it's not atrocious, largely because it reflects very healthy patterns of thought. But I think this is a real mistake.
Yeah, I mean, I guess especially the size of the bet means it kind of magnifies, like the size of the bet and the size of the pot means that even the kind of a small gap between how often you win and how often you need to win gets amplified.
Yeah, and like, I think 3 years ago it would have been a bit of a better fold. I think more people are bluffing and some stuff that's like trickling down to Weekend Warrior 2-5 players is stuff like, oh, I have a blocker, or oh, I have the worst hand in my range or something, whether or not they're thinking about it that way. Like, I had somebody kind of own me the other day at that, you know, 2-4, 2-4, 10 game in New Hampshire. He like value bet second, third pair on the river, half pot against me, and I didn't think that was really possible. And like, I think it's sort of a new world, and given that the overall play of the hand makes it so hard for us to be beat here, I think it's a fold that reflects a healthy state of mind, but I think in a vacuum it's a pretty bad fold. I think this loses a lot of money.
Yeah, that's fair. Well, thank you, John, for sending the hand, and we actually have a similar hand coming to us from Rodney. And I was a little torn about putting this hand on the show because Rodney's email begins, "Hey, Andrea," but I'm gonna assume that that was just a typo on Rodney's part.
Yeah, or autocorrect, like, you know.
It yeah, could be, maybe his wife's name is Andrea, and so he writes a lot of emails to Andrea. It just came out naturally.
Or, I mean, you know, or he knows like a lot of Italians. Like, there are a lot of dudes named Andrea.
Rodney's hand comes from a 1-3 no-limit hold'em game. Rodney says, "I was in the big blind with two red aces. The villain limped under the gun. One other player limped. I raised to 15, which is pretty standard in this position. The villain I know very well. He's a fish and loves to play all types of garbage cards like 7-3 and King-8 with no attention to position." Yeah, I think raising to 15 is fine. I could see a case for raising a little bit bigger. I mean, quite similar to what we discussed in the previous hand. I mean, on the one hand, if the guy is really loose, that's kind of an argument for raising bigger. On the other hand, like, we don't want to raise so much that he starts folding the 7-3 and the King-8. So it kind of depends on, like, at what price do you think he's going to be sensitive to, and start folding some of those really hopeless hands.
Yeah, I do think that a lot of 1-3 weaker players will have some sensitivity between 15 and 20 with a hand like 8-4 suited, yeah. Queen-7 offsuit, a hand like that. So if that's the case, I like the 15. That said, it's a great reason to know your opponent sort of more in more detail than he's loose or he's weak, which is not to say that Rodney doesn't, but it is to say that, you know, a more nuanced read has a lot of benefits at every stage of a hand.
Yeah, but yeah, the thing is just a hand like 7-3 is so hopeless against pocket aces that the value of keeping that hand in the pot is really high relative to just getting another like $3 to $5 out of it. Like having a hand like that fold is probably costing you a good deal more than like putting an extra $3 to $5 in the pot. So you don't want to get too ambitious in terms of, especially if you're not that deep to begin with, like, and you're probably not in I guess the effective stacks here are like 400. So I think even raising to 25, we'll be able to get stacks in a decent amount of the time, or sorry, raising to 15. Yeah. Maybe that is starting to push it a little bit in terms of whether we can get stacks in, but, yeah, I mean, it's important to keep him on the hook, is what I'm saying. when they've got such a hopeless hand, it is a big loss to fold them out, and it would be a shame to do that in the hopes of getting another $3 into the pot.
Yeah, especially given that a lot of these players will call too much with a gut shot or with any pair on the turn or something like it gets even worse. They're
magnify their mistakes after the flop, so you can easily get that $5 back with interest if you let them see the flop.
Yeah, but you know, at the same time, if they are going to call the 20, then you make the pot bigger, and that's great. So those extra, and that amplifies those extra mistakes. But yeah,
so our hero does raise to 15. The under the gun villain calls the 15, and the other player folds. So with effective stacks of 400 and probably about $30 in the pot after the rake, we see a flop, which is 3-5-6 all diamonds, and our hero is holding red aces, so he has the ace of diamonds. and Rodney says, I have the top pair with a nut flush draw and decide to check to this player because he is often one to make moves. Oh, you know what? I kind of glossed over this fact. Rodney's in the big blind here, which does actually make me like raising a little larger preflop. I think given that he doesn't have position on the opponents, you know, probably will be and should be a little bit more inclined to call if they're going to have position after the flop. So I like raising bigger a little bit more now that I remember Rodney's in the big blind.
Yep.
So Rodney checks to the villain, and I think that's a pretty reasonable thing to do with red aces here, especially if the villain is inclined either to you know, to be overly bluffy, to, you know, to bluff with like hands that it turns out are going to be drawing dead against aces or close to dead against aces, or if the villain is kind of overly concerned about protecting his hand. So you know, if he's the sort of player who could see this flop with like king five no diamond and then think, oh well, I've got probably the best hand, but there's three diamonds out there and there's a straight draw out there and I have to bet big to protect it, we would love to give him a chance to make that mistake. And the kind of worst case scenario of the villain checking behind is not that bad, because in all likelihood, if the villain checks behind, it's going to mean that he didn't really connect with the board in any way. So we'd like to give him a chance to connect with a turn card rather than just betting and having him fold. So I think Rodney's decision to check this flop is pretty defensible. What do you think?
I think it's very defensible. It matters so much exactly what kind of player you're playing against. Sometimes players who play any hand, they just want to see if they win. They're just playing bingo. And against a bingo player, I would rather bet, I think. But especially sort of in the modern era of poker, a lot of people will be defaulting to betting a little bit more after you show weakness. And then I like the check, especially given all the king eight hands that have almost nothing going on. Then I like the check.
Here's where it gets tricky. So Rodney checks. The villain bets 25, saying, I bet that you won't call. And Rodney says, I decide to raise to 80. I'm a little torn on whether to check raise the flop. I'm curious your thoughts, Nate.
Yeah, that's a fun spot. So I think loose chatter is often strength. So if we're just talking about the speech at the table, I think that other things equal, we should read this 25 bet as stronger than the average 25 bet. That's we have the average 25 bet just crushed. Like, we're doing very well against that. So there should be plenty of suited hands that beat us. But A, we have the ace blocker, which matters a lot. B, we have outs against those hands. And C, anybody who's playing tons of suited hands is probably playing a lot of you know, random big card, low card hands, like queen five or whatever.
Right. If he's playing king seven of diamonds, he's probably also playing king six of spades.
Yeah, exactly. Or king five offsuit, or right. Second five, 7-5 of clubs. That said, I think that a lot of reasons that people will have to bet here are often sort of is often because they have an element of a draw. So they have a pair and either a straight draw or a flush draw or both. I'm not sure those hands are terribly compatible with the talk. So I think we have a close decision. Raising probably can't be that bad. Like you could really see opponents having top pair or top pair and a flush draw or an over pair like eights and being really, really happy about this flop. Fours without the four diamonds, fours with the four diamonds, 5-4, 6-4. There are a lot of hands that could put opponent in a chatty mood, especially in position. That said, there are some pretty good reasons just to call, leave his range wide, and play a turn also. I think this is a very close decision. If I did raise, I might raise a little bit more, set up a turn shove a little bit easier. I think most hands that will call a raise will call as much as 100 or 125, and that'll make the turn easier to shove out of position. There won't be a lot of turns that'll put us in a terrible spot. An offsuit four would be not great. An offsuit seven would be not great. But for the most part, board pairing cards will sometimes improve him, but will very often not improve him. You know, we're just going to hit a lot of safe turns.
Well, and I think it's important that, like, even the bad turn cards are not generally turn cards where I would feel obliged to fold. So even if they're not, even if they, like, hurt my equity, I mean, they're going to hurt my equity either way. Like, I mean, I guess unless he folds to the flop check raise, and as long as I'm not going to get pushed off of my equity on the turn, which I don't think is going to happen, then, I mean, if you get a bad turn card, I would still check and call.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not check folding a seven.
Yeah. I think that's right. Especially since a lot of players are going to bet too small.
Yeah. The thing that I find most telling here is that Rodney doesn't really give a reason for his raise to 80. You know, I think he gave us a reason why he made a somewhat... I mean, I like the flop check a lot. It might even be, you know, quote-unquote standard for me. But, you know, I realize it's not, like, a, you know, a standard check for a lot of people, or a lot of people would prefer to bet here, as we discussed in the previous hand, just seeing, like, oh, I have a strong pair and a strong draw. Of course I'm going to bet. It was a good flop for me. And I think Rodney, you know, does a good job of thinking about alternatives and explaining why he chose to check the flop. And then he just says, I raised to 80, as though, you know, it's obvious why he would raise to 80. And although I think it's defensible, I definitely don't think it's obvious. I think there's a lot of good reasons to just call. And what's even more telling is what Rodney ends up saying on the turn. So the turn brings the Jack of Clubs, which makes the board 6-5-3 all diamonds plus the Jack of Clubs. Rodney has red aces, and there's like 190 in the pot now, with 289 remaining in the effective stacks. The turn comes a Jack of Clubs, and I checked. Rodney says, my thinking was that the villain may slow down from my flop raise. And that, I'm not real sure what that means or why that's a I mean, I guess I kind of know what it means, but I'm not sure why that's a good thing. I mean, so, okay, we've raised the flop. If we're raising the flop, it should be because we think that we're ahead and that we're going to be able to put the money in. So I don't know why now we would be thinking in terms of, like, slowing down or not wanting all the money to go in. Like, if after your flop check raise is called, you're going to feel like you don't want to play a big pot and you don't want to play for stacks, then you shouldn't be check raising the flop, right? If you're check raising the flop, it should be because you're thinking, well, there's enough worse hands out there that are going to be ready to stack off to me that I want to build a big pot. So I don't think you want to be check raising the flop and then saying, oh crap, this pot is getting big, I better check and hope my opponent slows down. You know, if we don't want money going into the pot, then let's not put money in the pot.
Yep, I like it.
The villain goes all in for 289, so he jams 289 into 190 or whatever. Rodney says, I hated the spot, but eventually called because of the ace of diamonds, and this player is definitely capable of doing this with a pair and a big diamond. And, I mean, given that latter fact, I think it certainly makes sense to call if there's a chance that he, you know, has a pair and a king of diamonds or whatever, then, yeah, I mean, I think this is a fine call regardless. Like, I don't really see myself check folding here.
Yeah, some players will always have it here, but especially a bet that's so big, it can be... Yeah, it's not great news, but I still think we're ahead here a lot. I think, you know, it's like sevens with the seven of diamonds, ace jack with the jack of diamonds. You know, it's just there's. I think a good reason not to call is if you think he has two pair a lot, like 6-5, 6-3, 5-3. There, if this player can have every combination of those, or at least a lot of combinations of those, like it matters a lot, I think, whether this player would play 6-5 offsuit and 5-3 offsuit, and I guess 6-3 offsuit, but that'll be a little less common. If he can have all those, then I think that starts to give him a lot more value combinations. But I think so many players will, you know, try to bluff you, or will have a perceived big draw. 6-4 with the four diamonds, 5-4, pocket fours, pocket sevens. There are just tons and tons and tons of hands. You know, 7-8 with a diamond, and you know he's betting a lot on the turn for a reason. Probably he's trying to protect something. So, yeah, there are made hands he could have. There are some straights. There are two pairs. He could have a set, but you know, we have outs against those hands, and there are also one pair of hands that he could try to protect, and there are also a lot of hands that look like they have a big draw to him.
As it happens, the villain had 4-7 of clubs for a flopped straight. Nine of hearts peeled on the river, so Rodney did not win the hand. Again, though, I do think that, like, once you're check-raising the flop, you're sort of making a decision that you're ready to play for stacks, in which case I think you should play for stacks on a pretty good turn card. And if you're not going to feel good about playing for stacks, then the primary thing I would say is just don't check-raise the flop. Like, if you think that as long as he's betting the flop, he's representing a better hand than yours, you have an extremely good bluff catcher. But recognize that you're playing it as a bluff catcher. If you think his flop betting range is polarized enough that you don't want to be building a huge pot against it, then don't build the pot. That's the main thing that I want to emphasize here. But I like the creativity or the open-mindedness behind checking the flop, and I would just, you know, encourage you, Rodney, to extend that thinking towards maybe just calling rather than raising the flop. But thank you for the email.
Yeah, very good. Thanks to all our correspondents and to all our listeners, of course.
And again, you can email us your hands, podcast@thinkingpoker.net. And I actually may have just discovered yet another excuse not to drive to National Harbor, which is that it actually might be flurrying outside right now. A little bit of snow coming down here in Maryland.
All right.
Not unheard of in March.
No, certainly not, despite the early spring.
All right. Well, enjoy your weekend, Nate. And hopefully, yeah. Are you playing? Did you say whether? I know you mentioned you were a bit torn about. You had some similar which casino to go to difficulties. Generically, are you going to be playing poker this weekend?
Very likely, almost certain. Not totally sure. But if I have a chance, there's some personal stuff that could go one way or the other. But I'm certainly hoping to.
Nice. Well, have fun.
Yeah. You too. Take care. Bye.
Devotion of a Carmelite, the fair passage of a bill, and who will sign us into law? I know you won't, you won't, you won't, you won't. Will you? You won't, you won't, you won't, you won't. Will you? You won't, you won't, you won't, you won't. You won't sign. I drafted up a beautiful contract. Intact, all of